Hello and welcome to Sound Body, a weekly program of information on health topics and ideas that can help you live life to its fullest. I'm Louise Craig. One of my favorite books is Nickel and Dimed by Barbara Ehrenreich. After reading about her years spent living life at minimum wage, I appreciated the depth of her curiosity and commitment. So when I read that she's decided to give up on preventative care, I wanted to learn more. At the same time, the New York Times published a story titled, "Preventive Care Saves Money? Sorry, it's too good to be true." So it seems that even the notion of preventive care as the gold standard for health needs to be re-examined. That is what we will read about today in three articles. Let's start with Your Body is a Teeming Battleground, written by Victoria Sweet for the May 2018 Atlantic Magazine. This is a review of Barbara Ehrenreich's newest book, Natural Causes, An Epidemic of Wellness, The Certainty of Dying and Killing Ourselves to Live Longer. I don't know, is it just me or are titles getting longer on books? Here we go. I went to medical school at least in part to get to know death and perhaps to make peace with it. So did many of my doctor friends, as I would find out. One day, usually when you're young, though sometimes later, the thought hits you. You really are going to die. That moment is shocking, frightening, terrible. You try to pretend it hasn't happened. It's only a thought, after all, and you go about your business, worrying about this or that, until the day you put your hand to your neck in the shower, say, and what is that? Those hard lumps that you know at first touch should not be there, but there they are, and they mean death. Your death, and you can't pretend anymore. I never wanted to be surprised that way, and I thought that if I became a doctor and saw a lot of death, I might get used to it. It wouldn't surprise me, and I could learn to live with it. My strategy worked pretty well. Over the decades, from all my patients, I learned that I would be well until I got sick, and that although I could do some things to delay the inevitable a bit, whatever control I had was limited. I learned that I had to live as if I would die tomorrow, and at the same time as if I would live forever. Meanwhile, I watched as what had been called medical care, that is, treating the sick, turned into health care, keeping people healthy at an ever-rising cost. In her new book, Barbara Ehrenreich ventures into the fast-growing literature on aging, disease, and death, tracing her own disaffection with a medical and social culture unable to face mortality. She argues that what makes death such an intolerable prospect is our belief in a reductionist science that promises something it cannot deliver, ultimate control over our bodies. The time has come to rethink our need for such mastery, she urges, and reconcile ourselves to the idea that it may not be possible. Ehrenreich is well equipped for her mission. She has a doctorate in biology and years of social and political work behind her, as well as decades of writing. I also learned that social progress is not always an upward trending line. The author of more than a dozen books, Ehrenreich has a reputation for chronicling cultural shifts before others notice them. She delights in confronting entrenched assumptions, popular delusions, grandiose ambitions, and in teasing out their unexpected consequences. Often she incorporates firsthand experience into her analysis. For her best-known book, Nickel and Dimed, on Not Getting By in America, 2001, she spent a year working at unskilled jobs. Before that, in 2000, she'd been diagnosed with breast cancer and begun paying special attention to surprising new science about cancer cells and our immune system. Now, 76, Ehrenreich explores that science in Natural Causes, An Epidemic of Wellness, The Certainty of Dying and Killing Ourselves to Live Longer. Once again, she is swept up by big questions. Not least among them is whether the natural world is dead or in some sense alive, and behaving in unpredicted and unpredictable ways that have much to tell us about our approach to mortality. She starts by looking at the many preventive medical procedures we are encouraged, even badgered, to undergo. Those regular physical exams, colonoscopies, blood tests, mammograms. She'd always pretty much done what doctors advised. She underwent chemotherapy, figuring that it made sense to treat disease before illness overwhelmed the body. But after watching many fitness-obsessed people die early and realizing that she herself is now old enough to die, she questions that premise. Where is the evidence that all the effort at prevention saves lives or delays death? It's hard to find, she discovers. In people who have a strong family history of heart disease, treating high cholesterol does decrease mortality on average. But for those who don't have that predisposition, it doesn't. Colonoscopies have not been proved more effective at reducing deaths from colon cancer than other cheaper, less invasive tests. Sometimes procedures cause more trouble than they prevent. Mammograms, for instance, detect tumors that might never be fatal and can lead to overtreatment, which carries its own risks. The insight is counterintuitive. Although finding diseases early on should prolong lives, the screenings we undergo don't seem to lower mortality rates overall, and Ehrenreich decides that she will no longer get most preventive care. She is just as clear-eyed about other approaches to delaying our decay, exercise, diet, meditation. Though she became a fitness devotee herself in middle age, she finds symptoms of cultural malaise rather than health benefits in the fitness and diet obsessions of the past 40 years. Wellness programs do little to reduce companies' immediate healthcare costs, and the pursuit of fitness, Ehrenreich argues, is often simply one more class Q. Workouts easily become just that, work, another demand for self-discipline, competition, and control. Ironically, when she reached her 70s, her knees began giving her trouble, not from age-appropriate arthritis, but from overexertion. Turning from her critique of preventive medicine and fitness culture as death postponement strategies, Ehrenreich is even more unsettled by research indicating that her immune system is not the magical protective cloak she learned about in graduate school. What really gets her rethinking her scientific beliefs is the evolving story of the macrophage, the specialized white blood cell that she always thought of as her good shepherd through the valley of the shadow of death. Macrophages have traditionally been understood as one of our crucial first-line defenses against disease. They are found throughout our body, in our bones, brain, lymph nodes, lungs, and breasts, and circulate in our blood. They look like amoebas we learned about in high school, those slippery, one-celled, independent creatures that move by stretching out and contracting, and eat by wrapping themselves around their prey, invaginating and absorbing it. The usual story went like this. Whenever macrophages find threats to our well-being in our midst, bacteria, viruses, fungi, or cancer cells, they kill them and eat them by engulfing and absorbing them. Ehrenreich assumed that keeping her immune system and valiant macrophages strong through exercise, diet, and positive thoughts was the key to not getting sick, not getting cancer, not getting old. But research around the turn of the millennium suggested a different view. Macrophages do not always kill our cancer cells. Sometimes they even help them grow and spread. They escort certain cancer cells through the tight walls of our blood vessels and protect them as they circulate in our bloodstream, looking for a congenial new home. When such a site is found in a breast or bone, liver or lung, macrophages then support those cancer cells as they mature into the metastases that will go on to kill us. Scientists are now discovering that the macrophage is as much wolf as shepherd in other diseases as well. It may play a role in autoimmune disorders, and even in the usual afflictions of aging, heart attacks, strokes, arthritis. We thought we knew the causes of those, cholesterol, cigarettes, inactivity, and therefore the recourse, diet, abstinence, exercise. But now it appears that inflammation, caused in large part by our macrophages, may be a trigger. Ehrenreich ponders the heretical question, can it be that instead of working to keep our immune system healthy, we should all along have been doing the opposite? Ehrenreich is not, however, an apostle of unwellness, and Natural Causes is not a how-to book. Instead, she focuses on the conceptual and deep moral reverberations of the discovery that our immune system can aid and abet a cellular rebellion against the entire organism. What if our convenient, holistic, utopian view of the mind-body as a well-ordered mechanism kept in harmony by positive thinking and solicitous tending is wrong? Ehrenreich proves a fascinating guide to the science suggesting that our cells, like the macrophages that sometimes destroy and sometimes defend, can act unpredictably and yet not randomly. It is almost as if our cells can choose when and how to behave, unregulated by any deterministic mechanism. But that would mean they have agency, or the ability to initiate an action, as she puts it. And what would that imply? If macrophages are actually deciding which cancer cells to destroy or to preserve, maybe, crazy as it sounds, they are not following any kind of instructions, but doing what they feel like doing. Researchers are now finding this same agency everywhere, Ehrenreich reports, in fruit flies, in viruses, in atoms, electrons, and photons. Such discoveries must mean that agency, the capacity for making decisions, electrons jumping up a quantum level or not, photons passing through this hole in a screen rather than another, is not the rare and human prerogative we once thought. Ehrenreich detects a paradigm shift in the making, away from holism and toward a biology based on conflict within the body and carried on by the body's own cells as they compete for space and food and oxygen. This vision of the body as an embattled confederation of parts, the opposite of a coherent whole subject to command and control, is dystopian, she writes, and yet it has liberating, humbling implications. If there is a lesson here, she proposes, it's that we are not the sole authors of our destinies or of anything else. Of course, the struggle to win the battles within our body may be one we'll never be able to resist. Who knows? Perhaps we'll devise high-tech ways to induce or persuade our traitorous immune cells to cooperate with our health. But whatever technological miracles appear in our future, Ehrenreich hopes we can come to accept that the ultimate outcome will be, as it always has been, out of our control. I've noticed in my life as a doctor that the truism is true. People die the way they've lived, even the demented and even somehow the brain dead. The brave die bravely, the curious with curiosity, the optimistic optimistically. Those who are by nature acceptors accept. Those who by nature fight for control die fighting for control. And Ehrenreich is a fighter. Yes, because I've also noticed that everyone I've seen die does come to accept the inevitable loss of control at his or her final unavoidable death. Usually that happens over weeks or months, sometimes over years. Occasionally it happens over days, hours, or even minutes. This acceptance is perhaps as developmentally determined as childhood, adolescence, adulthood, and old age. At the end, something magical appears to occur, something beautiful, something other, that seems to heal the spirit, allay all fear, and settle, finally, the struggle for control. And the author of that is Victoria Sweet. She's the author of Slow Medicine, The Way to Healing, and God's Hotel, A Doctor, a Hospital, and a Pilgrimage to the Heart of Medicine. We move now to the New York Times, written by Aaron E. Carroll and published on January 29th, 2018. Preventive care saves money? Sorry, it's too good to be true. The idea that spending more on preventive care will reduce overall healthcare spending is widely believed and often promoted as a reason to support reform. It's thought that too many people with chronic illnesses wait until they are truly ill before seeking care, often in emergency rooms where it costs more. It should follow then that treating diseases earlier or screening for them before they become more serious would wind up saving money in the long run. Unfortunately, almost none of this is true. Let's begin with the emergency rooms, which many people believed would get less use after passage of the Affordable Care Act. The opposite occurred. It's not just the ACA. The Oregon Medicaid health insurance experiment, which randomly chose some uninsured people to get Medicaid before the ACA went into effect, also found that insurance led to increased use of emergency medicine. Massachusetts saw the same effect after it introduced a program to increase the number of insured residents. Emergency room care is not free, after all. People didn't always choose it because they couldn't afford to go to a doctor's office. They often went there because it was more convenient. When we decreased the cost for people to use that care, many used it more. Wellness programs based on the idea that we can save money on health care by giving people incentives to be healthy don't actually work this way. As my colleague Austin Fracht and I have found from reviewing the research in detail, these programs don't decrease costs, at least not without being discriminatory. Accountable care organizations rely on the premise that improving outpatient and preventive care, perhaps with improved management and coordination of services for those with chronic conditions, will save money. But a recent study in health affairs showed that care coordination and management initiatives in the outpatient setting haven't been drivers of savings in the Medicare Shared Savings Program. There's little reason to believe that even more preventive care in general is going to save a fortune. A study published in Health Affairs in 2010 looked at 20 proven preventive services, all of them recommended by the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force. These included immunizations, counseling, and screening for disease. Researchers modeled what would happen if up to 90% of these services were used, which is much higher than we currently see. They found that this probably would have saved about $3.7 billion in 2006. That might sound like a lot, until you realize that this was about 0.2% of personal health care spending that year. It's a pittance. And that was with almost complete compliance with recommendations. One reason for this is that all prevention is not the same. The task force doesn't model costs in its calculations. It models effectiveness and a preponderance of benefits and harms. When something works and its positive effects outweigh its adverse ones, a recommendation is made. This doesn't mean it saves money. In 2009, as part of the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation Synthesis Project, Sarah Goodall, Joshua Cohen, and Peter Newman exhaustively explored the evidence. They examined more than 500 peer-reviewed studies that looked at primary, stopping something from happening in the first place, or secondary, stopping something from getting worse, prevention. Of all the interventions they looked at, only two were truly cost-saving. Childhood immunizations, a no-brainer, and the counseling of adults on the use of low-dose aspirin. An additional 15 preventive services were cost-effective, meaning that they cost less than $50,000 to $100,000 per quality-adjusted life year gained. But all of these analyses looked within the healthcare system only. If we really want to know whether prevention saves money, maybe we should take a wider perspective. Does spending on prevention save the country money overall? A recent report from the Congressional Budget Office in the New England Journal of Medicine suggests the answer is no. The Budget Office modeled how a policy to reduce smoking through higher cigarette taxes might affect federal spending. It found that such a tax would cause many people to quit smoking, the desired result. In the short term, less smoking would lead to decreased spending because of reductions in healthcare spending for those who had smoked. In the long run, all of those people living longer would lead to increases in spending in many programs, including healthcare. The more people who quit smoking, the higher the deficit from healthcare, barely offset by the revenue from taxing cigarettes. But money doesn't have to be saved to make something worthwhile. Prevention improves outcomes. It makes people healthier. It improves quality of life. It often does so for a very reasonable price. There are many good arguments for increasing our focus on prevention. Almost all have to do with improving quality, though not reducing spending. We could do well to admit that and move forward. Sometimes good things cost money. And we're going to start the invention of prevention. This comes from MedPage Today by Carolyn Poplin and published on December 12, 2017. Concern has mounted for 40 years over the inexorable rise of U.S. healthcare costs despite mediocre health outcomes compared to other advanced countries. Particularly since 2000, healthcare movers and shakers have convinced Americans that the solution is prevention. If the healthcare system focuses on maintaining consumers' health, then they will avoid illnesses that require expensive treatments and costs will decline. In this way, we will finally bend the cost curve. After all, who wants a sickness system? Adults can stay healthy, it is said, by getting routine checkups and recommended cancer screenings and flu shots, also changing their behaviors, as counseled by healthcare providers at regular visits, eating less and better, exercising more, and eschewing fast food, tobacco, alcohol, and opiates. The trouble is, the medical system is really not the best tool for primary prevention. It's neither efficient nor particularly effective. It's also very expensive. The most effective way to improve the health of a population is to improve the so-called social determinants of health: education, income, employment, environment, social supports, etc., about which more shortly. Why isn't the medical system more useful for primary prevention? It's hard to make a healthy adult healthier. It's true we bring in cars for routine maintenance. However, cars are mechanical, and these days electronic. Mechanical things are expected, sometimes intended, to fail over time and need to be checked, even replaced, to prevent accidents while driving. People are different. Their structures are infinitely more complex, generally do not fail simply from the passage of time, and are not easily replaced. Disease or injury, on the other hand, can damage bodies and minds. Most serious health problems are usually apparent to the victim, who knows his or her body the best and should trigger a prompt visit to a doctor. It often takes 7 years of medical training or more to treat serious problems. It's what we do. There are a few important treatable diseases which are common but clinically silent, for which providers should screen at regular intervals: hypertension, high cholesterol, and type 2 diabetes. Although we currently screen for 4 kinds of cancer: breast, mammograms, cervical, pap smears, prostate, PSA, and colorectal cancer, usually colonoscopy, on the theory that if we catch them early, we can cure them more easily, all except colonoscopy have become controversial. There's growing evidence that we screen too often, which drives up cost without identifying any additionally clinically significant cancers. Also, that excessive screening leads to treatment of small cancers, which might never have progressed. So not just increasing cost from unnecessary services, but also causing discomfort, even injury, from unnecessary treatment. Surgery, chemotherapy, and radiation are not benign. Indeed, in 2012, the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force withdrew its recommendation for prostate cancer screening, leaving the decision to each patient and his physician. Finally, there is no evidence of reduced morbidity or mortality from routine physical exams or diagnostic tests, apart from the above, on healthy, low-risk adults. Unnecessary exams not only increase costs, but can hurt patients. Then there's the problem of the incidental finding, as our test results grow more detailed. Consider CT colonography, basically a CT scan of the colon, a non-invasive alternative to colonoscopy. Since the gastroenterologists at my hospital were doing a study comparing the two, I offered my patients the option. One of the first reports came back: the colon is okay, but we see something in the liver. Not sure what it is, consider liver scan. As the patient's internist, I'm responsible for follow-up. I don't want to miss a cancer, so I ordered the liver scan. The lesion in the liver turns out to be a non-problem, but the radiologist sees something in one lung, and so it goes. This happens all the time. The more tests one does, the more often it happens. Finally, even visits for minor acute problems can cause harm to the patient or to even the population. Acute upper respiratory tract illness, for example, colds, acute bronchitis, sinusitis, sore throat, etc., is still the most common reason people visit primary care providers. For decades, doctors treated these conditions with powerful antibiotics. However, we learned years ago that most of these illnesses are viral and self-limited. Antibiotics, which treat bacteria only, are ineffective. As one of my colleagues would say, if I prescribe an antibiotic, you will get better in 7 days. Otherwise, you will get better in a week. The result of millions of useless prescriptions is a high level of resistance to important antibiotics today, in individuals who have taken many, as well as the population at large. and the drugs themselves often have unpleasant side effects. It may be better for a healthy adult to wait for a day or two and see if the problem gets better or worse. If it gets bad, then of course go in. Regarding the medical system, I'm convinced that the best way for a healthy adult to stay healthy is to stay away from it. Although it's a good idea to make a connection with a primary care doctor who can treat you if you do get sick. The most effective way to improve population health is to attend to the social determinants of health. Lots of good jobs at good wages, education, decent housing, a safe, attractive environment, good social supports. As James Marks says in the Huffington Post, speaking for many others today, your zip code may be more important to your health than your genetic code. Researchers have published data which suggest that greater attention to social determinants explains why OECD countries, members of the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, have better health outcomes with much lower healthcare costs. Analysts dispute the relative importance of the different determinants, but everyone agrees that the medical system contributes no more than 10% to population health. For any skeptics, we have a shocking example right in front of us, from a Nobel Prize laureate, no less, and his wife. As midlife morbidity and mortality rates fall for most Americans, including African Americans, Sir Angus Deaton and Anne Case have demonstrated that early mortality for one specific group, non-Hispanic whites ages 45 to 54, with no more than a high school degree, is rising, particularly from drug overdoses, alcohol and suicide, as well as a slowdown in progress against heart disease and cancer. The authors labeled these deaths of despair and attribute them to an increasingly difficult, declining labor market for this group, leading to measurable deterioration in economic and social well-being. The recent rapid spread of illegal opioids, of course, has only made the situation worse. Our medical system can treat disease. Only society as a whole, at the community, state, and national level, can prevent it. And that comes from Dr. Carolyn Poplin and was published in MedPage today. So I hope that's given you something to think about in terms of preventive care and your own health decisions. I thank you for tuning in to Sound Body today. Please stay well and come back next week for more healthy living ideas. This has been Sound Body, a production of WXXI Reach Out Radio in Rochester, New York. I'm Louise Craig, and I hope you'll join me again next week for more health updates and information for healthy living. If you'd like to hear this program again, you can download a podcast of the show at our website, wxxi.org.